Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, I'm joined by Chad Glasser, and he is the Senior Director of Clinical Research for Tecento Therapeutics. He has a big story to tell. There's great things happening at his company, and I'd love for our listeners to hear about it. So I thought it was important for him to come on our podcast and to share with everyone all the great work that him and his team are doing and how it is benefiting our mitochondrial disease community. So welcome, Chad. It's so nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So probably a good place to start would be for you to tell us a little bit about your background of you and how your company came to be. And then we'll get into where your company is at now and what all it's doing.
Sure. So I'm a pharmacist by training. So I, instead of taking the retail and hospital route, I decided to jump into biotech and an industry about 13 years ago. Following pharmacy school, I did a postdoc clinical research fellowship, and I've stayed in clinical research ever since. I've worked in a few different companies in the Boston area over those last 13 years, some rare disease companies, and most recently have been more focused on our MELOS program and our lead asset here at Tecento, and I've been a part of this team for the last 6 years. So I've been thinking about mitochondrial disease for a decent amount of time. I think the story of our company is an interesting one. So I was actually looking back to see when I did one of these podcasts a few years ago, an Energy in Action podcast with Cyclerion, as I was kind of talking about our previous study, our phase 2A study in MELOS. And at that time, you know, Cyclerion had kind of developed the molecule and discovered it and was evaluating it in a range of different indications. And it is a mechanism that's quite broad. We think it has a lot of potential, which is both good and bad. There's a lot of indications it could work in, but it's also challenging to pick the ones that you really think it's going to work, you know, the best in. So MELOS, of course, was one of those. We had a few other ongoing kind of signal seeking studies. And of those results across all of those programs, it was really the MELOS study results that were the most encouraging, that kind of had the most excitement from investors and from partners and from clinicians, and also really the unmet need of you know, where the need, you know, the patients are really voicing. Of course, it was extremely high in mitochondrial disease. There's been a lot of challenges along the way. And so all of those things kind of culminated to us spinning out that program into a separate company. And of course, we're called Tecento Therapeutics now, and it's kind of a small subset of the folks at Cyclerion that were working on that program. And that is our entire focus as a company right now, is moving that molecule forward, enrolling patients in our ongoing study, and hopefully, you know, getting a drug to patients as quickly as possible.
Wow. I mean, it feels good to hear someone say that their company's entire focus is related to mitochondrial disease and to the progress of improving life for a subset of those who have it. I mean, to me, that's like music to my ears. I feel like I walk around and there's, you know, people that don't know a thing about it, about this type of disease, even in healthcare. So it's important for someone like you to be doing the work that you're doing. And I'm so glad that we can share your story on the podcast and teach everyone what you all are doing and how maybe they can get involved themselves. I love why your company is named Tecento. Can you tell everyone about that?
Yeah, it's something I think we are really proud of. And it's a nice daily reminder of what we are trying to do and why we do what we do every day. So Tecento in the Italian language translates to I hear you in English. And it was a name that was suggested by one of our internal employees at the time, because we were really, you know, we were being spun off and we were trying to figure out how to design our clinical trials and figure out what our path to approval looks like. And again, this is a very challenging space. And not a lot of precedent. And I think one of the things that we felt was important was to use the patients and the patient's voice as a way to make some of those key development decisions. What are the symptoms you want to prioritize, and how do you want to design your trial? And so at that time, we were conducting an interview study with patients with knee loss and also experts that treat knee loss patients, and better understand from their perspective, what are the signs and the symptoms and the impacts of knee loss on their daily life. And that was really important for us as we figured out what outcome measures and what our kind of analysis looked like for our clinical study. I think the other aspect of kind of listening to patients is, as you said earlier, I think a lot of patients are saying we need new options and we need new treatments. And a lot of companies, you know, are kind of shying away from the challenges of rare disease and conducting studies in this space. And sadly, I think over the last few years, and as we've seen with other programs, there hasn't been a ton of success and there's a lot that we need to figure out. But I think that's what excites me to go to work every day. And I think our team is prides ourselves on being nimble and problem solvers. And I think if I was working on a program that was extremely straightforward and you knew exactly, you know, what to do to get to approval, and you, you know, knew that you could enroll that study with no problem, it wouldn't be as fun or as rewarding, I think, to work in that space. So it's a constant reminder of like, we're really trying to figure out how to get this drug move forward. And we really are trying to incorporate the patient voice as much as we can, you know, throughout our development. So it's, like I said, it's big shoes to fill. And I think a lot of companies say that they're patient focused, but we're really trying to live that and, you know, walk the walk, talk the talk.
Mm-hmm. That's really great to hear. I mean, I've personally done two clinical trials, and I had never heard all these details from the other side of it, you know, and I want to think that they had the same attitude, you know, but it feels good to hear this information. It feels good to see that progress is being made. So why do you believe your compound works most efficiently in patients with knee loss?
So it's a complicated question. I think it's really just where we started. I think what we know right now is, you know, some of the signals and some of the effects that we saw in our previous study, which really did focus on knee loss. And I'm sure we'll talk about it, but our hope for this drug is beyond knee loss. So we do believe that it will impact patients, you know, with other syndromes, you know, different types of mitochondrial disease.
So that is a goal of yours.
That is a goal of ours. Okay. Yeah. But, you know, as again, lessons learned from other programs and talking to other sponsors and kind of reading, you know, the results of those studies is that heterogeneity is a really big challenge. You know, all patients are different with mm-hmm. across mitochondrial disease. And as much as you want to enroll, you know, a broad range of patients and help with feasibility in your clinical trial enrollment projections, it ends up creating noise potentially in your data set. And so we knew that knee loss was a relatively well-defined phenotype and something that if we were to focus our clinical trial, that would make sense. Knee loss is also a very neurological kind of manifested disease. It's not just muscle, which is, you know, across a broad range of mito syndromes, but it is very CNS or central nervous system focused. Our drug specifically works not only in the periphery, meaning like throughout the body, but also in the brain. And so when we were thinking about, you know, where could we have the greatest impact? Where's the largest unmet need? Knee loss was really towards the top for those reasons. And I think, you know, there's other therapies in development that are maybe more focused on muscle and primary mitochondrial myopathy, but ours is, again, very much CNS focused. So as I'm sure we'll talk about, some of the outcome measures in our clinical trial are really focused on some of the cognitive aspects of knee loss and that neurodegenerative kind of deterioration that happens after those patients have stroke. To summarize, it was really our first foray into the space. We wanted to really increase our probability of seeing a signal and understanding the right outcome measures to use. And then I think once we established that, we would look to expand that more broadly.
So it's so easy to think to yourself like, oh, well, we should have a bigger patient population in our data. It'll be easier to move forward. It'll be easier to prove it to others. But you're right. It does really probably confuse what you're looking at. And you could hopefully have really good success here and then, you know, dovetail and go off, you know, create a a new goal, but maybe stay within mitochondrial disease, it sounds like.
That's the plan. I mean, I think, you know, regulators and everyone always suggests that you have as homogeneous as a population as you can in your clinical trial. It doesn't necessarily mean that your label will be, you know, have the same criteria that your study did. But it at least for our initial trial, we really want to make sure that we have a clear effect and remove a lot of those unknowns in such a, you know, challenging and variable population.
I love the name Tecento. I love what it means. I love that that's really your focus. So from a patient perspective, how would I see that you're doing those things on a daily basis, really hearing your patient?
Yeah, so I would encourage everyone to visit our website, which is at tecentotx.com. But we do have some information there about a qualitative interview study that we recently completed. As I mentioned earlier, this has been submitted for publication. So hopefully, you know, once that's accepted and published, we, you know, we'll ensure that all of our stakeholders, and including MitoAction, you know, has the ability to kind of plug that and get patients to access it and read it. But it really, like I said, was a way for us to understand the MELAS disease experience. And I think there's been other studies that other sponsors have done and other research institutions have done, speaking to patients with primary mitochondrial disease or primary mitochondrial myopathy, focused, you know, more so maybe on fatigue. And I think our study is unique in that, again, it was really only enrolling patients that had MELAS. And so we enrolled 16 participants with MELAS, and we interviewed them, and we assessed kind of their disease experience and what their quality of life was like, what are the impacts, things that they can do and that they can't do that are important to them, and really distill down what are the most bothersome, most frequent symptoms that we should look at in our clinical trial. And so that, you know, one of the biggest challenges of rare disease drug development where there's no precedent is, what is your primary outcome measure or primary endpoint going to be in your study? Again, in such a heterogeneous disease. So you have to find something that, one, is frequent, but two, from a patient perspective, is going to be meaningful, and they're going to understand why you prioritize that. And when, you know, hopefully you get a label and you say that your drug is improving, you know, these aspects, patients will appreciate that is a very large component of their disease experience. So the results of that qualitative interview study were really influential in all of the outcome measures that we picked and how we kind of finalized the design of our clinical trial.
If I have MELAS, do I automatically qualify?
I wish I could say yes. Again, going back to the challenges of clinical trial design and trying to ensure that you do get, you know, proof of concept in a relatively homogeneous population. You know, the first study does have certain criteria, of course, to ensure that it could, you know, has a high probability of success. So I think there's four that are most important to kind of talk about. Of course, there's a long list of things that the site would go over with any interested participant. But the first one is age. So we're starting in adults. You know, obviously, as you move into pediatrics, it becomes a little bit more challenging in terms of the outcome measures. So we're doing that work kind of in parallel and hope to get there one day. But you have to be an adult. You have to have genetic confirmation. So we need to know that there's genetically, you know, a reason for that manifestation. We're focused on mitochondrial DNA mutations. So that's generally consistent with how I think experts think about MELAS, is that it's primarily driven by mitochondrial DNA mutations and not nuclear DNA mutations. And this was also something I think, again, regulators pushed us on and said, you know, you want to make sure that you do have a homogeneous population. So we're focused on genetically confirmed mtDNA mutations, and they need to have kind of clinical findings that are consistent with MELAS. So this is basically a prior history of stroke-like episodes. And I know stroke-like episodes can be kind of broad in their manifestations. They can look very differently, but we do need just at least one MRI or image in the past that shows that there is evidence of a metabolic stroke, again, consistent with the pathophysiology of MELAS. So we're really, really trying to select the right patients that do truly have MELAS. And I think even the definition of MELAS has changed over the years and has been used kind of interchangeably with certain genetic mutations like 3243. So we've been really thoughtful about ensuring that not only do they have a genetic confirmation, but they also have clinical findings as well. And then because we are prioritizing fatigue and cognition as kind of key symptoms, we do want to at least confirm at that screening visit that patients do have those symptoms to an extent that we could improve it. You know, it's finding that balance of you don't want them to be too mild, but of course you don't want them to be too severe either. So it's really walking that tightrope. It's really tough designing these studies, trying to include a broad range of patients, but also ensuring that you, again, are setting yourself up for really detecting your treatment effect.
Well, it seems like you're being very thoughtful about the design of it. So how many participants do you have right now?
So we're making our way through enrollment. I think that's one of the reasons you can see on clinicaltrials.gov where it's posted that we're targeting 44 participants. We announced that we dosed our first patient in January, and we've had some nice progress since then. I wouldn't be on this podcast if we weren't trying to plug this study and looking for patients. So we've had some really great progress and actually one significant pivot with our design where we had a number of patients come in and we had some screening data across all of these cognitive tests. And we really kind of fine-tuned the cognitive tests that we use for eligibility as well as in our primary endpoint based on that data from that first kind of wave of subjects. And so I think we're feeling really good about the study design and the outcome measures that we selected. And it's really, you know, supportive of it's supported by that data that we've collected in the first few patients. So we are looking for patients. Enrollment, of course, is never as fast as it should be, you know, from our perspective. So we're really pushing sites and we're trying to get the word out to hopefully make this move more quickly so we can move on to hopefully, you know, a pivotal trial after this.
Just, I know personally, being in a clinical trial can be a very big time commitment. I would do anything to be a part of a clinical trial, but it's a big commitment. What type of commitment is your trial for these particular patients?
Yeah, so I can talk a little bit about PRISM, kind of its design and some of the aspects of it.
So this current phase is called PRISM?
PRISM, yeah. It stands for Phase 2B, Randomized Investigation of Zygosquat for MELAS. I think that's right. But I think the two most important letters are Z and M. So Z stands for Zygosquat and M stands for MELAS. So,
okay.
And it's a phase two study. So we, you know, we tried to find something that would stick, but it's with a Z. Yeah. It's with
PRISM
a Z.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Thank you. It's with a Z instead of an S.
Because of
our drug name. So yeah, so it's called PRISM and it's a crossover study, which I think has been used by some other sponsors in this space. And it's a pretty well-known study design, but basically any subject that is enrolled will be randomized to receive active drug and placebo in a certain sequence. The difference is that the patient won't know and the site won't know. No one will know whether they receive active drug first or placebo first. And so there will be what's called a washout in between those two treatment periods. And so they won't receive anything at all. Each treatment period for this study is 3 months. So basically the whole kind of treatment period for this trial is around 7 months in duration. So 3 months in that first period, 1 month washout, and then a 3 month kind of period too. And the beauty of this design is, again, going back to variability and limited number of patients, is really trying to maximize the data that you get from each individual subject, trying to use them as their own kind of control or comparator. It's difficult when you're kind of comparing across patients because not every patient, again, is the same.
It's feeling things the same. Yeah.
So that helps for a number of reasons, like statistically with our analysis, but it also helps hopefully patients understand that when they do sign up for the study, they will get active drug at some point during mm-hmm. that randomized placebo-controlled period. That's unlike other studies where they're, you know, double-blind placebo-controlled, but you could be on placebo for a very, very long period.
Right, right. I've only been in that type of trial.
Yeah, so that's one aspect that I hope makes this attractive.
I think that's a huge incentive.
Great. There is an open-label extension, which is a kind of a subsequent trial that if patients fare well and complete the crossover, both periods, they should have the opportunity, they'll be considered for the open label extension study. And that is, open label means that everyone gets drug, everyone knows they're on drug, and it is for a longer period of time. So that's kind of hopefully like a prize at the end of the study, you know, if you make it all the way through.
It's the best prize you could probably give someone.
Yeah, but yeah, they... they can have access to study drug at the end of the study. A few other things I think that hopefully are attractive to patients is that we are allowing at-home visits for a number of the study visits.
That's a big deal.
So between basically day one and end of treatment, so the day one visit in each treatment period needs to be in the clinic and the end of treatment visit needs to be in the clinic. So those are 3 months apart. But in between there, we do have monthly visits that can be done at home. And so we've contracted with a nursing service that we feel quite confident in. I think that we'll do this really well. But they will come and do a safety assessment, kind of work in concordance with the site, you know, collect any labs that are necessary or any other assessments. And then the patient doesn't have to travel to the site. So I know that there are a number of patients that are traveling to these, you know, academic centers and centers of excellence, and coming in for monthly visits is challenging. So that's one aspect I think that hopefully is patients find attractive. Zigosogwat's also oral. I don't think I mentioned that earlier, but it is an oral once daily medication. So it's easy to administer. Again, it may be different than some of the other compounds that have been studied to date. And all of the travel, all of the expenses, you know, that are part of traveling to the site and getting to the site are reimbursed. So we encourage, you know, patients to submit, you know, to have those paid for. And, you know, there's nothing that we won't really consider to make this easy for the patient to participate. All of our primary outcome measures and how we're assessing those are in the patient's home. So that's what allows us to do a number of these treatment visits at home and remotely. So they will have their phone to answer some questions on a questionnaire. And then we also have iPads that we're distributing where they'll do some hopefully fun kind of cognitive tests that are based on like a card deck as well as a maze. And so they have to complete those. And that's the data that we'll be analyzing, hopefully showing that their processing speed is improving and their executive function is improving and their memory and, you know, things that patients are complaining about that, you know, are impacting their daily life.
Seems approachable, right?
We hope that, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we've gotten great feedback so far from the participants that have been in the study. Obviously, setting up the device is the biggest challenge at that screening visit, making sure they have, you know, the login, which, you know, sometimes the caregivers will help with. But once they're set up, I think patients really get into that routine of when that window opens to do those assessments, mm-hmm. you know, they do them. And our compliance has been quite good. And of course, we're staying on top of it and reminding sites to stay on top of it, because that is very core to our primary endpoint and what we're really focused on in the study. But it's been going well so far. So fingers crossed that continues.
That's wonderful. So are you registering at sites internationally, or are your sites primarily just in the States?
So we this is a global study. I think we do have a large number of sites in the US, primarily, you know, all of the kind of mitochondrial network sites. So, you know, all the ones that you would imagine. Outside of the US, we do have two sites that we're looking at in Canada. We have two sites in Germany, three sites in Italy, two sites in Australia, and then two sites in the UK. So we're, you know, we have 25 sites looking for 44 subjects. We know, again, this is a rare disease and enrollment is challenging. So we did want to, you know, cast the net a little bit wider and improve our chances of hitting our enrollment goal, you know, a little bit earlier by going outside of the US. And we know there's a decent patient pool and some great patient advocacy groups as well, you know, outside of the US and some of those other countries that mm-hmm. we've been targeting. We've been working very closely with them as well.
This is really interesting. I wish we could have 10 chat glassers and you could all be working, even create more of like a warp speed effect, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to move as quickly as possible. I think, you know,
there's only so much you can do, though.
There's only so much
you
can
do. It's a slow process.
Yeah. It's hard. I think, you know, patients, we understand that every patient is different and their decision to participate is their personal decision. And it's not something that is taken lightly. And it might take time for them to come to that, you know, willingness to participate. And so we know that all these sites have patient pools. And I think that's what's challenging is really trying to project how many of these patients will want to participate or are interested or are at a point in their disease experience where they, you know, want to be in a clinical study. So I think educating and just saying, hey, this is an opportunity that's out there, you know, in this format and in other formats is really important. And then I hope that it makes patients feel more comfortable about clinical research and at least considering it. But yeah. I realize it's not for everyone.
Mm-hmm. I just feel like it's the best thing that I can do as just me myself to help further advancements down the road and for the future and, you know, possibly my own children. I can't imagine not valuing this, but I do recognize that everybody has a different perspective. But hopefully after listening to this podcast, there will be people listening that could be a candidate for the trial and they can see now themselves possibly in this more than they could prior to listening. You know, the fact that it is approachable and that, you know, everything is made very comfortable with visits being at home and the reimbursements for travel. So you really are trying to take into consideration that not everyone can just, you know, get to a center easily and go frequently, et cetera.
That's our hope. Yeah. I mean, again, we're trying to move as quickly as possible, but there's only so much we can do. So we're trying to pull out all the stops in terms of the design.
Our mitochondrial disease community is pretty well educated about how tough it's been right now for the BARS community as they face the FDA with such a small sample in their trial. What types of things can you do now to prepare yourselves since you'll be faced with the same potential challenge, a small base going in front of the FDA?
Yeah, that's the magic question. And I think that's something that we think about all the time as this study is you know, actively enrolling, is trying to predict the future and prepare for it. I think, you know, there's lessons learned from, you know, other programs that I've already kind of mentioned. And I think it is really important to try and get it right as early on in development and the first time, you know, as much as you possibly can. And I think educating and just being part of that conversation with all the key stakeholders to be transparent and to have that dialogue about the challenges, things that have worked, things that have not worked, and share that information is extremely important. And we're trying to do that. I think we have good relationships with a lot of those key stakeholders in the field. I think one example is there's a workshop coming up in a couple of weeks that the Reagan-Udall group is hosting, and they're kind of a separate arm, not affiliated. They support the FDA, but they're not necessarily influenced or biased by the FDA. And so they've been putting together an agenda for this workshop where they're inviting sponsors and FDA reps, academic researchers and experts, you know, key opinion leaders in MITO, to come together to present, to have a dialogue, to have a number of kind of panels to talk about, you know, lessons learned, things that we're doing, things that other sponsors are doing, how we're trying to overcome, you know, these known challenges in rare disease, specifically MITO and MELOS for us. So we'll be presenting there where we have a presentation along with other sponsors, including Stealth and Abliva. So it's, I think those types of things are extremely important, again, for regulators to know what we're facing. And I think so many times, and I get both sides, right? I understand why a regulator wants a statistically significant effect size, and they want to know for sure that this drug is working and that it is safe. Like, that's their job. But at the same time, there's, of course, the patient voice, and there's just our perspective of it's not possible for us to give you
that. It's literally not possible.
That level of confidence. So I think that's what we're trying to do, is find where's that happy median between, you know, their kind of gold standard and then, you know, what we're pushing for. I don't think anyone wants to get a drug approved that we think is unsafe or that is going to, you know, be deleterious to a disease or a patient group. That's never been the goal. But I don't know. I think for me, it's about having those conversations, going early. You know, we've had a number of interactions and kind of questions that we've posed to the agency and other regulators just to kind of get a feel for where they stand on our design and our outcome measures. And those have been really helpful. So I think, you know, really what we need is to complete the study, to get, you know, our data from this trial, to understand what our drug is doing, what outcome measures we want to prioritize. And, you know, hopefully that will allow us to design a subsequent phase 3 study. But I think, again, that our biggest challenge now is just getting patients enrolled in the study and getting them to take a chance on being in, mm-hmm. in the trial. And that goes for this study as well as like our confidence in being able to enroll a subsequent, you know, phase three trial. But obviously our hope is that if the study does have some encouraging results, that would incentivize patients, you know, to come
for sure.
And participate in a subsequent trial. But yeah, it's really challenging what's happening, I think, right now and what other sponsors are dealing with. And hopefully we're not in that same boat move forward and beyond that. But
and I don't want other people like you to be discouraged by what's happening with other, you know, like what's happening with the Barth community and not want to put forth the effort to finding drugs and therapeutics. And it's scary to me as a patient, you know, that people are going to turn their head.
That was the point I think I made in the beginning with our name and like what that means to us. And I know like the team that I work with, we all have that same sentiment. Like I love a challenge. Like I'm not the person that finds the path of least resistance. And I think that's part of our company culture. Mm-hmm. And we really try to be thoughtful and problem solve. I mean, the Mito community has been great. Like again, I've been on this program for the last 6 years and a lot has happened over those 6 years. And I think everyone knows the issues and the challenges. It's just like things are really starting to hopefully come together now after some other programs have gone through the gauntlet. And, you know, the regulators are starting hopefully to understand, you know, what we're faced with. But I hope that, you know, again, people hear our optimism and our engagement and also want to be a part of the space as well.
I hope so too.
I don't think it's slowing down. I think mitochondria, even in the broader sense, is getting more and more interest across a large number of stakeholders. It may not be specific to primary mitochondrial disease, but I think any research in mitochondria and their function and their impact in broader indications could really bode well for, you know, even the rare kind of subtype of PND.
Well, I like your perspective. I like your attitude. So if someone's listening and they think, okay, maybe this is for me, what should they do?
The first place I would send someone is to our website, which mm-hmm. I plugged earlier.
And that'll
earlier.
Be in the show notes. Yeah.
Yes. So I would go there first, and we do have a study page that hopefully is very patient friendly, that shows the design with some, you know, definitions of some of the words that we use, like, you know, open label or randomized or placebo controlled, if you're not already aware of those. Again, the eligibility criteria that I already talked about, certain aspects of the study that we hope would make the trial a little bit more palatable for patients that are on the fence. And then there's a link on that page that will take you to clinicaltrials.gov. And it's never a very user-friendly page, but it is, unfortunately, it's kind of the one-stop shop for clinical trials to see where sites are active and who's looking for patients and to see contact information for those sites. And that's updated pretty much in real time. As soon as a site is open, that will be updated and it will show, you know, who to contact. So if anyone is listening and they are curious, you know, there's a map there that link will take you to, and you can see where the centers are. You know, pick a center that you're willing to travel or drive to, fly or drive to, and reach out to them, and then they can talk about eligibility and see if you might be a good fit.
Okay, good information. And we'll make sure that it's all very clear within our show notes. Chad, it's been so nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for being so clear and informative. And I think that a podcast episode like this, even if you're not a MELAS patient or your loved one isn't a MELAS patient, you're giving me hope that there is stuff happening, you know, because it's easy for someone with a rare disease like myself, like to sit around thinking like nobody gets it. And, you know, there's not much happening in terms of research and development, but I'm really happy to hear that there is, you know, and hopefully if all goes well with this, you'll stay on this path and maybe I'll be a candidate for your trial one day, you know, and maybe others listening will be as well. So we'll make sure to continue having you on as the updates are, you know, available. But again, thank you for doing the work that you're doing. You're so appreciated by our community, and we need people like you. We really do. So thank you.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate all of those kind words. Hopefully this, you know, gets people curious about
yes.
the space of clinical trials and has an interest in potentially participating and learn a little bit more. Again, we need patients to move yeah. forward. And I know that's sometimes a lot to ask, but we're really relying on them to be a part of this journey as well. But yeah, thank you for having me. Anytime you want to talk about the study, we are, you know, here and waiting. We love to share our story and tell people what we're up to.
Great. Well, hopefully by listening, there's someone out there that feels more comfortable by the idea of it. And, you know, I've gone through two myself and they didn't amount to much, but I don't regret one minute of the time and effort I put into it because I know that it is for the greater good and it's important to our community. It's the least I can do, you know, from a individual level. So hopefully you'll hear from some people, you know, after this episode airs.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.